You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our first of two podcasts on advancing care for adults with limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, new therapies and insights, hosted by Med Learning Group. This series is designed for general neurologists involved in the management of patients with LGMD. In this episode, we'll be talking about the physical, emotional, social, and economic burdens associated with LGMD and its impact on caregivers, family, and healthcare systems. We'll also discuss the rationale for genetic testing and how it contributes to the timely and accurate diagnosis of LGMD. So let's get started. My name is Vaidehi, and I will be the host of today's podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Nicholas E. Johnson. Dr. Johnson is Professor and Vice Chair of Research and Director, Center for Inherited Muscle Research, CIMR. He's also the George Bliley Research Chair at the Virginia Commonwealth University, Richmond, Virginia. Dr. Johnson, thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you, Vaidehi. It's my pleasure being here.
To start off, can you tell us where LGMD fits in with all the various types of dystrophies that are out there?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think it's important to really think about the limb-girdle muscular dystrophies as part of an overlapping constellation of a variety of different disorders with limb-girdle weakness. So in other words, weakness that starts in the shoulders or hip girdles typically, although oftentimes it may involve other muscles as well. So, you know, within the disorders that can cause limb-girdle weakness, there are approximately 32 or so limb-girdle muscular dystrophies, but, you know, important to consider distal myopathies, myofibrillary myopathies, the dystrophinopathies, lysosomal storage disorder. So really over 300 different genes in total can cause this overlapping phenotype of limb-girdle weakness. And in some cases, in fact, some genes like FKRP may cause either limb-girdle muscular dystrophies or the congenital muscular dystrophy. So really, again, you know, important, and we'd start to kind of dig into the how to diagnose these things. But, you know, limb-girdle muscular dystrophies are one of the more frequent but causes of limb-girdle weakness, but not the only one. So what is a limb-girdle muscular dystrophies? Well, in 2018, the ENMC provided a definition. It has to be genetically inherited. I think that makes sense. It has to predominantly affect the skeletal muscle. It has to be progressive. So that's different than, say, a congenital myopathy, which is typically less progressive. And it has to be caused by loss of muscle fibers. And then one other differentiating feature that really separates it from, say, a congenital muscular dystrophy is that individuals must achieve independent walking and have a dystrophic pattern on muscle biopsy. However, you know, it's important to remember, as we get into the diagnosis later on in our discussion, that in many cases, muscle biopsy is no longer required to make a diagnosis.
Wow. So there are many subtypes of LGMD as well. And I know that there's a new nomenclature system out there. Can you briefly tell us about that?
Yeah. So this is probably one of the hardest things about the limb-girdle muscular dystrophies is that figuring out what subtype it is requires a bit of a dictionary. It's an alphabet soup type of situation. But the our old way of dividing the limb-girdle muscular dystrophies subdivided them as a dominant recessive, as type 1, LGMD 1 as dominant, LGMD 2 as recessive, and then a letter was given to the gene that was associated with that subtype. So for example, LGMD 2A is caused by loss of function of calpain 3, LGMD 2B caused by loss of function of dysferlin, and they were lettered in the order in which they were discovered. However, they got to LGMD 2Z, and you can imagine that by the time you found the next limb girdle, that would be called LGMD 2AA, which is a medical coding nightmare. And so now the letters and numbers have been switched in the new naming system. So LGMD R is for recessive, LGMD D is for dominant, and now the number gives you the gene that's associated with it. So LGMD R1 is still calpain 3 related, which used to be called LGMD 2A. LGMD2B is now R2, which is dysferlin related, and so on and so forth. And so this allows for more flexibility in terms of the naming system. The last point, if you kind of go back to thinking about the features that really make it a muscular dystrophy, in the new subtype system, some of the particularly dominant forms of limb-girdle muscular dystrophy were removed and are now classified differently. So one of the best examples is LGMD1B, which is due to dominant gain of function of the lamin AC gene. And this is now separated out into its own category. And so for some of the recessive limb girdles, it turns out when you really dug into literature, it was just really just a single case or an isolated incident. So really not quite sufficient to meet the some of the needs that you would have for to really consider it a disease. And so some of these have been removed as well.
It still sounds pretty confusing to me. So LGMD is a very debilitating disease. Can you tell us a little bit about the impact of this condition?
Yeah, I'm happy to. So collectively, the limb-girdle muscular dystrophies represent the fourth most common form of muscular dystrophy behind myotonic dystrophy, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and FSHD. But you know, as we kind of alluded to at the beginning, really, even amongst those fourth most common, there's a kind of an alphabet soup, a variety of different subtypes with varying degrees of prevalence. So the most prevalent of these is a little bit debated, but from a large gene sequencing program, the most prevalent subtype is calpain-3, which is LGMDR1, and second most prevalent is dysferlin. But really, after that, you have a rapidly decreasing degree of prevalence. And in some cases, these are really actually quite rare individually. It's important to remember, actually, from that large sequencing program, you know, maybe the sixth or seventh most common form of limb-girdle muscular dystrophy was still identified as Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which really highlights the overlap between the limb-girdle muscular dystrophies and the dystrophinopathies from a clinical perspective. Other genetic databases have suggested that Noctamin-5 is the most prevalent, followed by calpain-3 and then dysferlin and FKRP. But really, you know, those four subtypes are typically represented amongst the most most prevalent disorders. The sarcoglycanopathies are shortly following those collectively, although each individual subtype of the sarcoglycanopathies. Yeah, is collectively more rare than any of that calpain-3, dysferlin, Noctamin-5, or FKRP. So the limb-girdle muscular dystrophies, these are debilitating disorders. As we'll talk about later, there's not available disease-modifying therapies for these conditions. They are slowly progressive. The leading causes of impact relate to problems with mobility and ambulation, shoulder weakness, like you'd expect. But also important to recognize that in some subtypes, the cardiovascular system may be affected. In many of the subtypes, the pulmonary system is affected, typically later on in the disease. As with other forms of muscular dystrophies that are progressive and lead to a dysfunction of the mobility, ambulation, and general ability to use muscles, you know, there's a lot of emotional and social impacts that arise from that as well. So people feel isolated. They're not able to do what they want to do. It's typically quite challenging to lead productive lives, although it is possible. There's a burden on family members or other caregivers to help support individuals living with limb-girdle muscular dystrophy, which may lead to depression. And then maybe one of the things that's under-recognized, but as these disorders typically start in childhood or adolescence, there can be significant issues in terms of body image, you know, and the ability to engage with others in a socially productive manner. You know, all of that, the emotional and physical toll of this these conditions leads to accumulated increase in direct medical costs, and of course, lots of costs related to lost productivity, of both themselves, but also recognizing lost productivity and challenges of family members who maybe aren't able to travel for work or maybe need to take extra sick days to take care of their loved ones. So just, you know, there's a large economic burden as it relates to these disorders.
So in your experience, what would you say are the symptoms that patients are most concerned about?
So we did a survey a while back within our GRASP LGMD consortium, and it represents what you would largely expect. Individuals really spoke to limitations with mobility and ambulation, hip, thigh, or knee weakness, and then inability to do activities. When you separate it out from those individuals who are able to work, from those individuals who are not working, again, as you might expect, across the board, there were issues that were more impactful for individuals who were currently not working than there were for individuals who were working. But statistically speaking, beyond the well-recognized problems with shoulders or arms, inability to do activities, there were some issues that were specifically more challenging for those who were currently not working, like fatigue, difficulty with their body image, and then also problems with their breathing or respiratory issues.
Okay, so switching gears a little, can you tell us about how LGMD is diagnosed?
Yeah, so for a long time, we really focused on a histopathological diagnosis of the limb-girdle muscular dystrophies. But really, with newer sequencing technology, more ubiquitous availability of sponsored sequencing for large genetic panels, you know, we've really turned that paradigm on its head. Regardless of it, no matter what diagnostic approach you're taking, fundamentally, the core features have to be established first. So in other words, you know, is it limb girdle weakness? Is it scapular perineal weakness? Is it more of a distal myopathy? And that family history is quite important. So, you know, is it X-linked, autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive? Some subtypes of limb girdle muscular dystrophy are more or less prevalent amongst different ethnic or racial populations. So capturing that information can be helpful as well. And you have to do that before you send any test, because should you end up with a unclear or uncertain test, you know, you're going to go back to that clinical phenotyping feature. Also, you know, beyond the clinical features and ethnicity, you know, the degree of the CK elevation can separate certain subtypes of limb girdle muscular dystrophy. Whether or not, for example, the heart is involved also can separate out certain forms of limb girdle muscular dystrophy. And then in some cases, an EMG can be helpful really for excluding some of those other kind of 300 different genes that are involved in limb girdle weakness, like myotonic dystrophy type 2 or acid maltase deficiency. So once you've kind of gotten through your physical exam, you know the pattern of weakness, you know the family history, you know the ethnic background, whether or not there's other associated features like cardiomyopathy, calf hypertrophy, and then you have some basic ancillary testing like a CK and EMG, you're ready to order a large next generation sequencing panel. And one of three outcomes will happen with that. In about 25% of the time, you'll end up with positive genetic test, and for the rest of the time, either it's a negative test or it's an uncertain test. And so, you know, at that point, you may need to do additional testing like a muscle biopsy to confirm a variant of unknown significance or additional genomic or exome testing. So, but this is quite different than older literature, which would suggest that you start with a muscle biopsy, then you do sequencing afterwards.
So in your opinion, should doctors be encouraged to refer their patients for extensive genetic testing as routine, or what do you recommend?
Yeah, so really, really emphasizing, and this is probably one of the key points in something that's been substantially different over the last 5 to 10 years or so, is with these larger next generation sequencing panels that are actually in the United States at this time of this recording are typically free to the patient because they're provided through sponsored testing. That should be the very first thing that's done. So a large next generation sequencing panel, you should not start with a muscle biopsy almost in any instance that I can think of. However, as we'll kind of talk about in a minute or so, if the tests are negative or equivocal, that's really the time to be thinking about the muscle biopsy after that initial next generation sequencing testing, and then recognizing that even at the end of the day, there's new or emerging technology like RNA sequencing or long read sequencing that can help clarify the diagnosis if it's uncertain. And of course, you know, we're rapidly evolving and moving into a situation where, you know, we can and should be thinking about, you know, maybe genome sequencing as newborn screening, because you know, should therapies develop, we know we want to deliver those at the earliest time point of life.
Is there any other things that you would recommend in this case?
Yeah, so the literature here shows that about 75% of the time, that initial gene sequencing panel is going to have what's called a either be negative or it's going to have what's called a variant of unknown significance, which means that that's going to get reported back as something, a mutation that either is not confirmed to cause disease, nor is it reported to be benign. And so in that situation, you've got to do some work to clarify that. And so here's some things that you can think about doing. So right off the cuff, you know, consider mimickers or things that are acquired disordered, like an HMG-CoA reductase myositis, an anti-SRP myopathy. And then, you know, these next generation panels don't typically test for things that can look quite similar to limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. So that would be myotonic dystrophy type 2, FSHD, or OPMD. And in those instances, you need to order targeted genetic testing. Once you've kind of thought through those things and you feel like, you know, that variant might be potentially required or potentially pathogenic, that's the situation where you're going back and you're thinking, maybe I should do a muscle biopsy. If I can quantitate that protein to show whether or not it's present, absent, or reduced, you know, do I need to evaluate other family members to see whether or not that variant is in trans, or is it both variants are present on the same allele, which would make it less likely to cause disease. You know, do I need to do other ancillary testing like MRI for something like VCP? So that's really, you know, those are things to be thinking about and doing if the testing is equivocal.
So how would one incorporate an evidence-based recommendation for genetic testing into clinical practice?
I think, you know, just really emphasizing that next generation sequencing should be the first step. And then acknowledging that, that's, you know, the challenge of resolving some of these variants of unknown significance is not insignificant. And as a practicing clinician, you know, a lot of people don't really have time to go through and do all this extra work. And so there are resources that are available for somebody in clinical practice. So once you get to that point, you have that variant of unknown significance, I would say typically the next step, like I said, if you've excluded some of these mimickers, you know, myositis or these repeat expansion or contraction disorders like myotonic dystrophy type 2 or FSHD, you're going to move to that muscle biopsy to quantitate the degree of protein if possible. And if you get stuck at any point in time, or you're not sure, hey, is this variant really potentially pathogenic or is it more likely benign? There's actually an NIH funded resource called ClinGen that is currently going through and curating all these various different variants to really in real time confirm whether or not they are pathogenic or benign or remain uncertain. And so you can go to this ClinGen, you can Google it, there's contact information there. So you can go ahead and reach out to them if you need additional assistance in resolving that variant. And just it really is a plea to all the practicing clinicians out there that if you're depositing or sharing that information with ClinGen and we do get to a place where you're able to resolve that variant, then the next time somebody gets that genetic test, they won't have the same problem. You will have solved it for everybody. So really, it is our collective efforts that's going to help reduce that very high number of variants of unknown significance, which makes sometimes getting genetic testing challenging.
So before we wrap up this episode, would you quickly share a case study with us where genetic testing played an important role in diagnosis?
Yeah, so we had a 35-year-old woman who was noticing that she was having difficulty getting off the floor in her mid-20s. She was having difficulty going up the stairs. She was having difficulty reaching over her head. On exam, she both had a limb girdle pattern of weakness and scapular winging. And that combination of features made us really think about, you know, could this be a limb girdle muscular dystrophy? Could this be something like fascioscapular humeral muscular dystrophy, which can also cause scapular winging and some limb girdle weakness? Could this be myotonic dystrophy type 2 or myositis? So we went ahead and performed that large next generation sequencing panel, which showed one pathogenic variant of calpine 3 and one variant of unknown significance, as well as one variant of unknown significance in dysferlin. So, and you know, just as background, the CK here was about 800. So we went ahead and moved forward with parental testing, which actually showed that each parent had one of those variants of calpine 3, so they're in trans. And that there's normal immunohistochemistry for dysferlin and there's absence of calpain 3 on Western blot. So at the end of that, we were able to really show that, you know, this individual had calpain 3, which out of the limb girdles is known to also include scapular wing.
Thank you. Well, we've run out of time for this podcast, but we have interesting topics to discuss in our next one. We're going to talk treating LGMD, including symptomatic treatments, and also discuss some investigational therapies in the works. So be sure to tune in. Thank you so much, Dr. Johnson, for taking the time to speak with us today and for all the in-depth information you shared. And thanks to all our listeners for joining us. Hopefully, you're able to tune in to some of the other podcasts in this series. There are a total of 2, as well as some of the many other types of CME programs we offer. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group, who in support of improving patient care is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, ACPE, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center, ANCC, to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our grant supporter, Sarepta Therapeutics, Inc., who provided an educational grant for this activity. Have a great day.